Ms. Evans contacted the Nation of Islam headquarters in Chicago, Illinois, hoping to speak with Minister Louis Farrakhan to ask him to confirm or deny the claim. She was told by Nation of Islam representatives that the organization would hold a press conference in the afternoon to comment on the matter. But at that time, they had nothing to say in response. Later that afternoon, shortly before 2:30 p.m., the Nation of Islam National Headquarters released a statement denying any involvement in the Oklahoma City bombing, saying, quote, "Nation of Islam officials emphatically deny any connection with the terrible act and, along with the entire country, pray for the success of public officials, rescue workers, and all those working to save lives and property," end quote. The Chicago headquarters announced that an official press conference would be held at 3 p.m., and further statements would be made at that time. That press conference was not broadcast in the Oklahoma City area. The rumors, claims, counterclaims, and denials about Middle East perpetrators continued at full strength for 2.5 days and would later reappear as other independent investigators, directed by the local news media, got underway. Only once was any effort made by the news media to discern and publicize the difference between the Nation of Islam and the Middle Eastern practitioners of the Islamic religion. That there was a substantial difference between the two groups, to say nothing of the differences between Muslims and Muslim fundamentalists, was never fully explained to the public. The general public was thus encouraged to believe they were all the same thing, and this ignorant and prejudicial view caused great tension in the Islamic communities of Oklahoma City, Norman, and Edmond. Dr. Emmy Shafir, a cardiologist and president of the American Muslim Association in Oklahoma City, addressed the situation in the newspapers. He had spent hours working at the bomb site, helping the rescuers and providing treatment to the injured. Dr. Shakir's wife, an anesthesiologist at St. Anthony's Hospital, had worked a 7-hour shift aiding the wounded until the hospital began to send medical personnel home when it became apparent that there were going to be few, if any, additional survivors. Said Dr. Shakir, quote, "There is an element of concern in the Muslim community until they find whoever did it, that there might be a backlash. As a doctor, as a parent, I can feel the tragedy. Nobody in the Muslim Association in any way condones the crime, and everyone hopes the criminals, whoever they are, will be punished," end quote. The media was asked to remain objective and calm, and to act with restraint. In the late afternoon, Ibrahim Hooper, a national communications director for the Council on American Islamic Relations in Washington, D.C., stated that the possibility of a Middle Eastern suspect did not mean that the suspect was necessarily a Muslim. Quote, "This is what happens in these situations. But there are no suspects. Why people jump to those conclusions that this was done by Muslims, I don't know. The thing is, members of the Muslim community hesitate to even discuss this, because even in condemning it, we're associating ourselves with it," end quote. The Council on American Islamic Relations, in conjunction with other American Muslim groups, issued a formal statement condemning the bombing attack as a criminal and immoral act. The statement also said, "To link this attack with the religion of Islam places millions of responsible American Muslims at risk." The sentiment of most Muslims in the Oklahoma City area was summed up by one gentleman who asked to remain anonymous for fear of retaliation. "We are just like any other Americans here. We condemn it as much as anybody else." That there are people of Middle Eastern descent in the Oklahoma City area should not have come as a surprise to anyone. There is a large, peaceful and well-respected Middle Eastern Islamic population in the metropolitan area. It is estimated at from 6,000 to 10,000 people. For at least two decades, the University of Oklahoma in Norman had attracted large numbers of students from the Middle East because of its excellent petroleum engineering and land management degree programs. The Oklahoma City area was home to many wonderful business and professional people of Middle Eastern descent, and the city of Edmonds, located 15 miles north of Oklahoma City, had recently erected a mosque in which Islamic worshipers practiced their religion. The aspirations cast upon those from the Middle East, all of whom were automatically and incorrectly assumed to be of the Islamic faith, were racist, prejudicial, and predictable. Many local citizens assumed that given the violent nature of the war in the Middle East, and the terrorist bombing of the World Trade Center in New York City, it was only logical that Muslim fundamentalists must have been responsible for the bombing in Oklahoma City as well. During the broadcast of ABC World News Now, John McWethy, reported from the Pentagon, speculated, quote, "The fact that it was such a powerful bomb in Oklahoma City immediately drew investigators to consider deadly parallels that all have roots in the Middle East. The car bomb has been a weapon of choice there for decades, and in recent years, the skillful bomb makers have exported their skills and often their extremist hatreds all over the world. The first horrible evidence of that in the United States was the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, end quote. Few local people, if any, realized that court documents filed in May following the World Trade Center event revealed that the Federal Bureau of Investigation had been implicated in the World Trade Center bombing, that it had supervised the building of the bomb, that it had planned and directed the event, and that an FBI employee even instructed accused bomber Mohammed Salama how to drive the infamous Ryder rental van 2 days before the explosion occurred. In addition to the court documents, the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times had published transcripts of tapes made between an FBI informant and his federal government handlers that clearly documented and demonstrated the degree of involvement of the FBI in the World Trade Center bombing, a disaster designed to achieve a specific political end. That the manipulated suspects in the New York tragedy were of Middle Eastern descent and were considered Islamic fundamentalists was very convenient indeed for providing ready-made scapegoats in the Oklahoma City bombing. A similar, and at times identical, scenario would play itself out in the local and federal investigations that followed. The Hour of the Time, ladies and gentlemen, is brought to you by Swiss America Trading. Swiss America Trading specializes in non-reportable, non-confiscatable hard assets, real money. I know that not too many Americans today have ever read the Constitution for the United States of America. They have some obscure idea that it talks about separation of church and state and things like that. It's a very short document. Consists of 11 articles. I carry a copy around in my shirt pocket or in my coat pocket. Always have one or two copies in my briefcase wherever I go. I memorized most of it many years ago. And one of the things that is very clear in that document and in the writings of the founding fathers of the Republic, ladies and gentlemen, and that is what constitutes money. And it's not that piece of paper you've got in your pocket. It's gold and silver coin. And the founding fathers had plenty of experience upon which to build their decision on what would become the money for the United States of America. You see, they were astute students of history. They had fled from the persecution of empires and kings and tyrants in the old world. They were escaping religious persecution. They knew what would happen if a religion controlled the state in the new world. And so they made sure that our government would not be a religious government, but it would be populated with religious people. For they understood that religion is the source of morals and ethics and good behavior. And that without a higher source to dictate to man, all of those things become subjective. And that is extremely dangerous. They also knew the history of how tyrants robbed the people by the creation of paper money. And so they made sure that our money would be real money, gold and silver coin. They even established a Bureau of Weights and Measurements to make sure that a dollar in New York would be the same as a dollar in Virginia, so that no one could be cheated. They gave Congress the power to coin money, not print money, not farm it out to someone else, not grant the ability to create money to some private corporation, not to create credit or debt, but to coin money. They further specified that no state shall tender in payment of debt anything other than gold or silver coin. So what is all this Federal Reserve note business? Well, folks, that's something you had better find out. Because if you don't, it will destroy you. And that's not a guess. That's not a rumor. That's not speculation. That's a promise. That is a promise. It will happen. It's all got to come tumbling down. You see, anything built upon a lie is nothing but an extension of that lie. And when the lie on the bottom, holding it all up, is exposed to the cold light of day, it must all come tumbling down around our ears. And only those who possess real money, as only those throughout history who have possessed real money, will survive the calamity of the economic downfall. And there are other things that you must do to survive the effects and the consequences of that downfall. So call Swiss America Trading right now. Tell them that you're a listener to William Cooper and the Hour of the Time. You'll get red carpet treatment, I guarantee you. Ask for a free copy of the current newsletter. Thank them for sponsoring the Hour of the Time and the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network. And ask them how you can get your hands on some real money. 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. And if it's easier for you to remember, 1-800-BUY-COIN. Do it now. You know how you tend to procrastinate. And if you'd like to find out how you can get your hands on a copy of Oklahoma City Day 1, call 520-333-4578 anytime during this broadcast or anytime tomorrow during normal working hours. That's 520-333-4578, and I will tell you at the end of this broadcast how you can order it through the mail. Listening to the Hour of the Time, I'm William Cooper. The rumors of Middle East terrorists were but the first of many speculations and false assumptions that would rule the day. Of even greater import, ladies and gentlemen, were the rumors that only one explosion had occurred on the morning of April 19th. There has always been an overwhelming amount of direct evidence indicating multiple blasts. But for some reason, federal officials denied then and continue to deny today that more than one explosion occurred. The first call for help was received by the Oklahoma City Fire Department within 3 seconds of the blasts. The emergency tapes revealed that the initial report described more than one explosion. Quote, "We have a large column of smoke to the south of this address. We just heard some loud explosions." End quote. The earliest eyewitness reports of the bombing indicated that people had heard the sounds of two distinct and separate explosions. Evidence would later indicate that there had been actually several explosions, occurring so closely in time as to sound to the ear like one detonation in conjunction with the detonation of the cover-up bomb, the proverbial yellow Ryder rental truck supposedly filled with many blue 55-gallon barrels of ammonium nitrate fertilizer mixed with fuel oil. To the ears of witnesses within a few miles of the scene, there were unmistakably two concussions followed by the long, low rumbling of the collapse of the Mura Federal Building. Brett Woolley, who lives approximately 3 miles northwest of the Mura Building, was in his front yard working on his car and listening to his scanner radio at the time of the explosions. He reported hearing two very loud, staccato-like explosions, separated in time by 5 to 8 seconds, and followed by a long, diminishing, rumbling sound like rolling thunder and lower in pitch than the first two explosions. Mr. Woolley stated that he first thought that the railroad cars at Northwest 36th Street and Broadway Extension had blown up, or that a natural gas explosion had occurred. Immediately thereafter, he reported the scanner radio, quote, "went nuts," end quote, as rescue workers began arriving at the scene. Jim Ferguson, one of the assistant building managers and the electrician and air conditioning foreman for the Mura Building, stated, quote, "Everyone in town, everybody who was there, knows there were two blasts," end quote. At the time of the explosions, he was in an office at the U.S. Federal Courthouse just south of the Mura Building. He firmly declares that he heard two distinct and separate explosions. Mr. Ferguson's wife was shopping a mile and a half away when the explosions occurred. She reported hearing two blasts about 5 to 8 seconds apart and said she saw two separate clouds of dust and smoke rising from the building. Two blocks from the Muir building, P.G. Wilson had been starting his day's work at the Investors Capital building when the explosions occurred. He said, quote, "The walls seemed to bulge out as if pulled by a strong wind, and debris fell from the ceiling and walls. A second explosion came after the first one, and shards of glass began flying in the office. The office employees ran from inside the building. The odor of sulfur was very strong." Two attorneys with offices in downtown Oklahoma City were both dictating correspondence at the time of the explosions. The taped records of the two explosive events and the rumbling of the collapse of the Muir building are clearly discernible on their audio cassettes. Michael Hinton lived in the YMCA building, located a half block diagonally northeast of the Muir building. He was standing on the corner of Northwest 5th Street at 8:30 a.m. on the morning of April 19th. Because he had missed the first bus that would have taken him to work, Hinton ran east another block to the corner of Broadway to catch another bus at 8:55 a.m. He remarked how thankful he was that he had chosen to catch the Broadway bus. His initial thought had been to catch the 9:05 a.m. bus that stopped directly in front of the Muir Federal Building. After boarding the Broadway bus, Mr. Hinton seated himself next to the bus driver and rode to the transfer terminal to connect with the bus he would take to the state capitol. He stated, quote, "I had just climbed aboard the bus and sat down when I heard this very violent rumble under the bus. It was a pushing type of motion. It actually raised the bus up on its side. About 6 or 7 seconds later, another one, which was more violent than the first, pushed the bus again, and I thought the second time the bus was going to turn over." End quote. The driver threw the bus into gear and beat a hasty retreat from the area. The passengers on the bus, all of whom distinctly heard and felt the two explosions, learned later that the federal building had been destroyed as they saw the streets filling with emergency vehicles. Just prior to the explosions, a staff meeting was underway at the Oklahoma Water Resources Board building, located on Northwest 5th Street, opposite the westernmost front of the Muir building. The audio tape of the staff meeting clearly recorded two separate explosions, the rumbling collapse of the building, and the panicked escape of the staff employees as they picked their way through the falling ceilings, flying glass, and collapsing walls of their building. Lieutenant Colonel George Wallace had had much experience with explosives. He had served in Vietnam and was a retired Air Force fighter pilot with 26 years in the service. From his home, 9 miles northwest of the federal building, Wallace was pouring a cup of coffee when, quote, "I saw it jiggle and shake. I immediately ran outside." End quote. As an experienced combat pilot, he stated that the explosions sounded like a succession of bombs being dropped in the distance, an unmistakable sound he had heard often in Vietnam. Dr. Charles Mankin of the Oklahoma Geological Survey, located in the Sarkis Energy Building on the University of Oklahoma campus in Norman, Oklahoma, granted an extensive interview about the interpretation of the seismic records of the events. Dr. Mankin stated, quote, "We had originally heard there were two explosions. That was what came over the radio. And so when we heard there were two, and we saw these two events on the seismic record, the logical conclusion was to say, well, the first one looks about right for the time, and so apparently the second one relates to the second blast. That was a hell of a blast. All I can tell you is that there were two events. They look very similar. We've done every analysis we can think of. We know it's not the air blast. There's no question about that. The time is dead wrong. Everybody has agreed to that. While we can't rule out a refraction, an echo, everybody that has looked at the signal has said a refraction would really be strange because there's Absolutely, no loss of energy in the recorded seismic signal. The second event has the same amplitude as the first. So if you get a refraction, like an echo off of a building, a refracted wave, you're going to have a loss of energy. You'll lose a part of the energy in the process, and so the fact that the two events are of equal intensity suggests, well, that makes it difficult. Secondly, the arrival time is wrong for a refracted wave. You're going to have to take it, the refraction, off the mantle or off of basement rocks or something. The problem with the shallow section of the Earth's crust between here and Oklahoma City is that we've got a pile of rather discontinuous sandstone and shale, a big delta called the Garber Delta. That's where we get our water. It's a big delta consisting of channels of sand that go from east to west, and they're irregularly scattered throughout this pile of material. There aren't coherent layers from which you could get a reflection until you get some depth. And if you try to calculate the travel time down and back up, the time is wrong, and it still wouldn't be the same intensity. So we've ruled out reflections, refractions, and the air blast. The thing I can't rule out is that there could have fortuitously been an earthquake somewhere. But we didn't pick up anything like an earthquake. So we determined it was a local phenomenon. From an earthquake, you pick up surface waves some distance away. But here, we knew the building was blasted. We knew where it was. We had the seismometer. We got this record and said, okay, if it was this building, then this first event would have occurred at 9:02 plus some seconds. And if you look at the signal, it looks very much like a quarry blast, very much like some of the information you would expect. So our interpretation of this event is that these signals on the seismic record are the building being blown up. Now, that interpretation was confirmed in an indirect way by the Omniplex seismometer sitting up in Oklahoma City. It picked up two events. Unfortunately, their clock was malfunctioning, so we couldn't get an absolute time number. But we saw the two events on our seismogram, and we saw the two events on their seismogram. We said the Omniplex was closer to the event, so should have a higher amplitude. It did. There should be two events if we are both recording the same thing. The Omniplex had two events, and we had two events. We determined that these two records of these two events corroborate our interpretation that there were two explosions. Do you understand what I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen? Do you understand what the research of the Intelligence Service of the Second Continental Army of the Republic has disclosed, the United States government, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, William Jefferson Clinton, and all of these other people are lying to us and have been lying to us since day one. And that's an aside. It is not printed in the book. That comes from me, from my heart to you, and you had better understand it. We are being lied to. We are being manipulated. This is an attempt at social engineering. And there is an abundance of historical precedents. What amazes me is that in the face of all of this evidence, the American people remain complacent, apathetic. As at Waco, oh, they were just a bunch of religious fanatics. They deserved what they got. They deserved to die. Will you be next? Will you be next? Or are you one of those people who say, it can't happen to me? Just like many of those people in Oklahoma City lost children and relatives and fathers and mothers and aunts and uncles and grandparents in the blasts, yes, blasts, plural, that destroyed the Alfred P. Mura Federal Building in Oklahoma City. For most of their lives, thought, can't happen to me. Nothing like that could ever happen here. The reason that it happened there, ladies and gentlemen, is because so many people believe that it can't happen in America. It can't happen in Oklahoma City. It can't happen in Salt Lake City. It is to bring terrorism to the American people so that they will consent to be disarmed. So that when the Constitution is torn to shreds and thrown into the trash can, and the world totalitarian socialist government is formed under the United Nations, or a perversion of the United Nations that is sure to come, they will not be able to resist it. And you had better understand that. Back to the book. Although we did not realize it at the time, the witnesses who reported hearing two separate explosions would not be heard from again that day or for many days to come. When their stories began to be told weeks later, few would be willing to allow their names to be used for fear of government harassment. Their stories were, were ever interviewed a second time. No account of the two explosions was recorded in the newspapers that hit the stands later that Wednesday afternoon. None of the newspapers published the next morning mentioned the two explosions. As far as the mainstream media was concerned, only one explosion occurred. In daily press conferences, the representatives of the media were told by federal officials what to say and how to explain the event to the public, and the media obeyed. Taking it a step further, approximately 2 months after the bombing, ABC National News claimed that it had just acquired the audio tape from the staff meeting at the Oklahoma Water Resources Board building, and a heavily edited version was aired on television. The televised version of the tape revealed only the first explosion, followed by very poorly executed and obvious audio edits leading directly to the panic-stricken escape section of the tape. The sounds of the second explosion and the collapse of the Mura building had been completely removed from the televised version of the Water Resources Board tape. One must assume that the sloppy editing had been done under the direction of ABC News. One has to ask, who ordered ABC News to edit the tape prior to national broadcast, and why was it so important to remove all evidence of the secondary explosion? Who or what was being protected by those audio edits? Why was the evidence being altered? The nature of the injuries that resulted from the bombing, the bodies of the dead, and the remains of the building itself all told a story that contradicted the official reports. Those official reports began taking over the airwaves by the afternoon of the day of the bombing. The building had been destroyed from both within and without. The fact that the entire north face of the Mura building had been blown 50 yards away to smash into the Journal Record building was the clearest indication that at least one explosion must have occurred within the building itself. For if the only explosion that occurred had been in the truck outside the building, parked next to the curb, the face of the building would have been blown into the building and not across the street. And I just added that last sentence. It is not in the book. Ladies and gentlemen, you have been listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper, and if you'd like to obtain a copy of Oklahoma City Day One, send a check or money order made payable to Harvest, H-A-R-V-E-S-T. That's Harvest. To Harvest at P.O. Box 1970, Eager, Arizona, 85925. You see, I just read you a few pages from the front. This book is 640 pages long, and what it reveals will shock you to your core. And all of it is documented, all of it is sourced, and you can obtain and verify the information for yourselves. send $34.95. That's $34.95 postpaid. Make check or money order payable to Harvest, H-A-R-V-E-S-T, and send it to Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, spelled E-A-G-A-R, Arizona, 85925. Once again, that's $34.95. Make your check or money order payable to Harvest, H-A-R-V-E-S-T, and send it to Harvest, P.O. Box 1970, Eager, Arizona, 85925. Good afternoon, or good night, wherever you are. And God bless each and every single one of you. And God save this republic. This is the Voice of Freedom. Thank you. listening to the Worldwide Freedom Radio Network with studios in Eager, Arizona, broadcasting on satellite GE1, transponder 7, 7.56 audio, and over 700 low-power FM stations across the nation and around the world. If you live in the Springerville, Eager area and would like to obtain a copy of Oklahoma City Day 1 by Michelle Marie Moore, you can save $5 by picking up your book at Stewart Books on Main Street in Springerville. We now return you to All Oldies, Most of the Time.